Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In October 1929, what many people thought would be an unending period of prosperity in America came to an end. A decade of unbridled optimism gave way to the collapse of the stock market and its devastating effect on the national economy. In a few minutes, our guest, Morty Klein, will be discussing his new book on the crash of 29 with Talking History's Fred Nielsen. Lewis Gould will also be joining us in our guest commentary. Gould points to what is wrong with the American presidency and explains how it got that way and what we might do to fix it. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on October 10, 1973, Spiro Agnew became the first U.S. vice president to resign in disgrace. Agnew pleaded no contest on the day of his resignation to a charge of federal income tax evasion, and in exchange, charges of political corruption were dropped. He was fined $10,000 and sentenced to 3 years probation. Spiro Agnew began his political career as chief executive of Baltimore County in 1961, becoming governor of Maryland in 1967. Nominated as the Republican vice presidential candidate in 1968, Agnew ran on a law and order platform. As vice president, he labeled anti-war demonstrators and liberals as un-American. When Agnew resigned, President Richard Nixon nominated, with the approval of both houses of Congress, Congressman Gerald Ford of Michigan as the nation's next vice president. Following Nixon's resignation the following year, due to the Watergate scandal, Ford became America's 38th president.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, in a creative use of insect genetics to solve an enduring mystery of human evolution, scientists studying the DNA of lice have concluded that human beings began wearing clothes much later than previously thought. The new work, based on genetic differences between human body lice, which depend on clothing for their survival, and head lice, which do not, has found that the transition of Neanderthals from being hairy to being hairless and from wearing animal skins to clothes occurred about 75,000 years ago. The study was published in the August issue of Current Biology. And archaeologists have found what may be a human bone scarred by the marks of a butcher's axe, probably the first physical evidence that the Donner Party, trapped in the Sierra Nevada mountains in 1846 by blizzards, resorted to cannibalism to survive. The discovery was made at a site on Alder Creek near Truckee, California. The Donner Party, some 81 strong, was en route from Illinois to California when they decided to depart from the frequently traveled trail to take what they thought would be a shortcut. They were trapped by early snows and forced to make winter camp. Before they could be rescued, their food was exhausted and they were forced to eat the flesh of their animals and deceased fellow travelers. This is Talking History.
Bad luck wind been blowing at my back. I was born to bring trouble to wherever I'm at. Got the number 13 tattooed on my neck. When the ink starts to itch, then the black will turn to red. I was born in the soul of misery. Never had me a name. They just gave me the number when I was young. Got a long line of heartache, I carry it well. The list of lives I've broken reach from here to hell. Bad luck wind been blowing at my back. I pray you don't look at me, I pray I don't look back. I was born in the soul of misery. Never had me a name. They just gave me the number when I was young. I I was born in the soul of misery. Never had me a name.
It is commonly believed that the Great Depression of the 1930s began with, or even was caused by, the stock market crash of October 1929. Our guest this week, Morty Klein, examines the crash, its causes, and its impact on the nation's economy with Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
After 1920, new technology transformed American life and helped drive the stock market to record highs. Experts declared that the economy had entered a new era in which old rules no longer applied and in which the only direction was up. Everyone, or so it seemed, wanted a piece of prosperity. And then in 1929, the bubble burst. The decade that had begun in optimism ended with the worst stock market collapse in American history. With me to discuss that collapse and its causes is Morty Klein, a professor of history at the University of Rhode Island and the author of Rainbow's End, The Crash of 1929. Professor Klein, welcome.
Thank you very much.
The 20s saw tremendous technological changes, electricity, radio, and automobiles, for example. How did those changes affect the stock market?
They affected the stock market in a number of ways. The period after World War I was one in which, for the first time, a large number of people understood what it was to invest in something other than savings accounts because they had bought war bonds. And when they had bought war bonds, they began to understand something about securities. At that very time, American business began to get much larger after the war. And as it got larger, new companies poured securities onto a growing securities market so that Wall Street, which had once been a kind of a private club just for people who invested and for the well-to-do, became increasingly a place where middle-class people might invest as well.
There were people, a lot of them it turned out, who believed during that period that the old rules of economics and investing no longer applied, that the country had entered, to use the phrase of the time, a new era. What were the supposed rules of that new era?
The old model was that the economy ran a predictable cycle, predictable in the cycle, not necessarily in when each part of the cycle occurred, in which it would sort of rev up, get overheated, suffer a bust, enter a depression, go through a depression, and then the whole process would start again. Somehow, because of the rapid growth of the economy and some other things that happened during the 20s, an increasing number of people began to argue that that old cycle no longer applied because there were not the forces driving the market down that there had once been, that the market had developed such a broad base of support, and that new products and new companies were constantly coming online, that it would only go up, that the old depression mentality simply didn't fit the new reality of a consumer-based economy and a consumer product-driven market.
Gravity had been repealed, in effect?
Pretty much, yes.
There are people in the 1920s, later on in the decade especially, who get swept up in the promise of profits on the stock market. And at that point, the stock mania begins to feed on itself. But I wonder if before that point there were individuals who can be identified as having helped create the frenzy in the first place.
Some created. The market had always had, and in fact had always been, ruled by professionals. And as the base as the investor base broadened, the professionals saw this as an opportunity to take advantage of it, and they began to create markets. By that I mean that wealthy individuals, usually led by some knowledgeable operator, would form insider pools, and they would use techniques to boost a stock or several stocks and ride it all the way up, getting other people to invest, and then they would sell out, and as they sold out, bad news would suddenly and mysteriously appear, the price would drop. And the people who would get clipped would, of course, be the outsiders that had no idea that all of this was being choreographed. There were a number of individuals, however, who literally helped create a market. Probably the best known of them was the guy they called Sunshine Charlie Mitchell, who was the head of National City Bank, which was the parent of what is now Citicorp. And Mitchell was the guy who first saw the broad-based market of middle-class average investors, first for buying bonds and then later for buying stocks. And he basically led the banking industry toward actively seeking out this market as a source of selling securities of all kinds. Before that, it had been pretty much institutions and wealthy individuals only.
Alexander Noyes was a financial writer for the New York Times during the 1920s, actually for much longer than that. I don't know if it's right to call him a hero of your book, but he certainly stands out as someone who was not swept up in the euphoria of the period.
That's right. He was one of the skeptics. There were a handful of these who, the higher the market got, the more dubious they were about its possibility of being sustained. To use your analogy, he did not believe the law of gravity could be repealed, and he kept reminding his readers of that. And he made a lot of people unhappy, particularly those who were bullish stocks, because they kept accusing him of trying to drag down the market. But he was, for a long time, a voice in the wilderness, until, of course, the crash came. And then the irony was that he had found himself having to warn people that just as the market had gone too high and people had overreacted, they had to now be careful not to overreact because it would go so low.
The crash comes in the fall of 1929, beginning in October, and depending on how far one wants to extend it, ending either at the end of that month or into November. It's a series of events, in other words. How much did the market actually lose during that period?
The market, there were two basic averages in those days. One was the Dow Jones, and one was an average that was run by the New York Times. If you look at the period of the fall from October 29th to November 13th, during that time the Dow lost, I think it was 39%, and the Times average lost 41%.
Who loses most? Is it middle America or is it the financiers on the inside?
Well, it depends. Part of the problem is we don't really know how many people were invested in the market. We know the market had become the topic of dinner time, club, lunch, golf course, all kinds of places. But there really is no reliable data on how many people were actively invested. We do know impressionistically that a lot of people suffered heavy losses and in some cases were wiped out. But the range of those is pretty large. It ranges from average investors who got carried away to the very wealthy, to even some of the insiders. Because this market kept falling, and what people don't understand is even after the crash and after a brief rally during the next 6 months, from about the fall of 1930 down to July of 1932, the market kept falling, and it didn't reach its low point till July of 1932. So even a lot of professionals who went back in trying to gauge where the bottom had been reached suffered heavy losses as well.
What caused the crash?
Well, that's a good question. It was caused by a number of things. And the analogy that I have used that I believe is the most satisfactory one, even though it's not the most appealing one to a lot of people who want one very clear reason, is it was like a perfect storm. It was the coming together of a whole confluence of forces. The market was oversold, the economy had begun to slow, the international monetary situation had begun to deteriorate, the flow of gold internationally had become lopsided. There were just a chain of events that started to come together. And during the summer of 1929, when the market was probably its most overheated of all, June, July, and August, it rose farther than it had the whole previous year, that could not be sustained. And as we know in the present, and it was true then, the market typically does not do well in the fall, particularly in September and October. And when you start adding all these other factors in, nervous investors began to sell off. And of course, remember, the higher the market is, the more nervous people get, because in order to buy when the market is high, you've got to believe that there's somebody out there that will pay an even higher price for what you're buying. So it becomes more difficult as the market goes up to sustain confidence that it's going to keep going up.
The optimism that stoked the market's rise was clearly, at least in retrospect, excessive. You mentioned earlier Alexander Noyes, the financial writer for the New York Times, worrying that the disillusionment that followed the crash might also be excessive. What about that? Obviously, people were disillusioned after the crash of 29. Was there disillusionment in proportion to the losses, or did they do what Noyes feared they might do?
A little of both. The thing that's important to remember is that the crash was a financial crisis. And a financial crisis does not necessarily spread beyond the financial community. In other words, you don't necessarily get a depression just because the market collapses. There have been a number of market collapses where a depression didn't follow. So when the market collapsed, the real thing bothering most people was not would the market come back, it was whether it would spread to the broader economy, because a depression is an economic crisis in which the entire economy begins to slow down and grind to a halt. And that was the worry from the time of the crash in the fall of 29 well into 1930. And the attempt was to try and avoid carrying the one to the other. Most of the spokesmen in business, in government, all of the people, the pundits, insisted that the economy was sound, that there wouldn't be a spillover, but it's very difficult to know to what extent they were just putting on happy faces or whether they really believed this. But it's clear that a large part of the country feared what was happening. It's the old parable of the glass half empty and the glass half full, that where it had once been half full, now they begin to see it as half empty.
Well, if we shift our perspective from 1929 to the present for a moment, looking back now, some 70 years, is there a connection between the stock market crash and the Depression? Did the one, in fact, cause the other?
No, it did not cause the other. It created a set of conditions that ultimately led to the possibility of a depression. For example, one of the strong points following the crash is that the banking system remained intact. No major bank failures occurred. There were two or three brokerages that failed, minor ones. But during the next year, the banking system had been weak for a long time, and there had literally been thousands of bank failures during even the good years. During the next year, the banking system itself began to weaken, and as it began to weaken, an increasing amount of money, because in those days there's no FDIC or anything, so if you have money in a bank and a bank fails, you've just lost it all. And a lot of banks had their deposits made up of the deposits of thousands of small investors. So as banks began to fail, money began to flow out of them, and the only place for it to go was basically under the mattress or behind the fireplace, brick or whatever. And as a result, a major problem began to occur in 1930 in the form of deflation. And deflation became the mortal enemy that's going to fuel the depression. Prices falling so low, farmers, for example, literally can't afford to take their crops out of the ground. And there's nobody buying even at low prices. And as the economy slowed, more people get laid off. As they get laid off, there's nobody to buy the goods. And yet, government policy and the conventional wisdom all were geared towards the fear of inflation. And so they were marching in the wrong direction in terms of policy. And so no matter how much confidence they tried to breathe into the economy, they were going in the wrong direction. And late in 1930, there began a series of really catastrophic bank failures. And when those occurred, the Depression was on in earnest.
This new era that we've talked about of the 1920s and all that it involved seems so reminiscent of the new economy and the irrational exuberance of the 1990s. Are there any parallels that are important that are worth our attention between the 20s and the 90s?
I think so. Obviously, they were very different times. The market in the 1920s was much smaller. There was no institutional buying. The market was completely unregulated. You didn't have any government regulation or oversight. And the government itself played no major role in the economy itself. But if you look at the forces that create a market, and if you look at the capacity for illusion, that's, I think, where the parallels are strongest. Investors ought to know that as a market begins to march upward and as prices of things become irrational, in other words, when the price of something is wholly out of whack with its underlying value, that's not going to last. It may go on for a while, but it's not going to last. And no matter how many people say it's a new economy, it's a new world, history has sort of proven otherwise.
Well, I sometimes think that one of the purposes, maybe the primary purpose of studying history, is to inculcate a sense of humility. No one else has repealed gravity, and we aren't likely to either.
That's right. One of my favorite phrases, and I can't remember now who said it, is that times change, but human nature doesn't.
Well, Professor Klein, thank you so much for visiting with us.
It's been my pleasure.
I've been talking with Maury Klein, the author of Rainbow's End, The Crash of 1929.
Back, and as long as we're on the subject of the stock market crash of 1929, we thought we would recommend to you, as our site of the week, the place where it happened. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beattie.
The crash of 1929 is commonly associated with the New York Stock Exchange, but the exchange has an even longer and more interesting history, which you can explore if you visit the 18 Broad Street location and take a guided tour. The New York Stock Exchange traces its origins back more than 200 years to the signing of the Buttonwood Agreement by 24 New York City stockbrokers and merchants in 1792. It began in a rented room in a house at 40 Wall Street. In 1865, it moved to a five-story building at 10 Broad Street, which was demolished in 1901 and replaced by the eight-story classical revival-style building designed by noted architect George Post, which now houses the New York Stock Exchange at 18 Broad Street. Centuries of growth and innovation later, the New York Stock Exchange remains the world's foremost securities marketplace. Visit its five trading floors to see the Stock Exchange in action and view its permanent and changing historical exhibits.
And finally, we turn to our commentary of the week. Our guest, Lewis Gould, tells us that the modern American presidency is broken. He points to the cause of its defects and suggests how we might fix it. Gould is the author of The Modern American Presidency, published by University Press of Kansas.
The modern American presidency is broken and needs fixing. One of its major weaknesses is the 22nd Amendment. That provision restricts presidents to two terms and imposes lame duck status after re-election to a second term. Where did this misguided addition to the Constitution come from? After Franklin D. Roosevelt had served three terms from 1933 to 1944 and been elected to a fourth term in 1944, the Republican Party, following World War II, pushed for the adoption of the amendment limiting the president to two terms. Passed by Congress in 1947 and ratified 4 years later, the amendment was designed to prevent another democratic dynasty like the one Roosevelt had established. Unfortunately, this part of the Constitution has done more to distort the workings of the presidency than to protect the American people from executive tyranny. By making a two-term president a lame duck the moment re-election occurs, the 22nd Amendment adds to the likelihood that a second term will be either trouble-ridden or anticlimactic. That is what happened with Dwight D. Eisenhower in the 1950s, Richard Nixon in the 1970s, Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, and Bill Clinton in the 1990s. Each of them in their turn encountered either political difficulties or debilitating scandals that left their presidencies well short of the results they had anticipated from a second 4 years in the White House. The solution, then, is to repeal the 22nd Amendment and return to the American people the free choice to have a president for a third consecutive term or to return as president after an appropriate interval for a third term at a future date. As Bill Clinton has recently suggested, a president elected during his or her 40s might serve two terms and then, in the midst of some future crisis, be the appropriate national leader once again. The 22nd Amendment, as it now stands, would make such a course impossible. In effect, the 22nd Amendment says that the American people cannot be trusted to make the right choices about who their president should be. That would have been a wrong judgment about Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s and 1940s during the Great Depression and the Second World War, and it will probably be a source of unnecessary problems in the future. The 22nd Amendment now has outlived its usefulness and ought to go. The modern American presidency would be better off without it.
You've been listening to Lewis Gould, the author of The Modern American Presidency, published by University Press of Kansas. Gould's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments and suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. If you'd like to learn more about Talking History and the Organization of American Historians, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.